Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and to Aboriginal elders emerging.
She had the three children and Scott was sitting in the front seat. He saw the gun come up and shot his mum in the back of the head. There's an expectation then that we need this to be solved, we need the community to be safe, so you take on board that pressure, and, you know, 13 years down the track, you're still going.
There was nothing in relation to Carmen's abduction that would have identified that crime as not being associated with the others. And it was on that basis that we conducted the investigation. They were most likely related, same offender. We were fortunate with the other girls that we got them back.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
He went into a kindergarten and took four children and locked himself, nailed up a toilet and stayed in there. Spread petrol around, splashed the kids with petrol. In that situation, we tried to talk him out. We thought, eventually we were thinking about, he kept sticking his head up, so do we pop him? If we shoot him, he falls down on the kids, kids got blood, blah, blah, blah.
All the parents are now coming to the kindergarten and, you know, this one drags out for 7.5 hours.
Bullet holes leading up to the laundry. Alphonse had made a run for the laundry. We surmised that he had a pistol there. So he gets shot at and then goes to the laundry. He's obviously wounded at this stage and we know he has a coup de grace. Someone shot him to the back of the head to finish him off.
So we go to this job with the person on fire. They're in a gutter and they were writhing around and people were screaming. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, because they were actually on fire. And I can't believe I did this, but I kneeled down next to them and I sort of grabbed the person's hand and I just sort of said, it's okay, I've got the ambos. And the person spoke to me. And I can remember when she spoke, I didn't know who it was. And I can always remember the teeth being so white. And the person said, Narelle.
These are the real voices of Australian true crime. Support us at patreon.com/AustTrueCrimePod and leave us a review wherever you download your podcasts. The following podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature and is not suitable for children.
And I was saying to people, she's going to die. And they're going, no, she's not. Don't be silly. She'll be fine. I'm like, no, seriously. She's going to die. She's brain dead. And, yeah, they just wouldn't. It's like, no, you're being silly.
Last week we told you about an upcoming podcast series that's going to be an in-depth look into the murder of Leanne Holland in Ipswich in 1991, the police investigation that saw Graham Stafford convicted for the murder, the two appeals that saw that conviction overturned, and the ongoing efforts of the Queensland Police Service to conceal the forensic report into their original investigation and the other persons of interest. This week we introduce you to one of the people behind that new podcast, who some of you will be very familiar with already. His name is Jamie Pultz, and he's one of the producers and hosts of the Beenham Valley Road podcast about the 2014 death of Queensland woman Kira McLaughlin. 27-year-old mother of four, Kira, died at the Gold Coast University Hospital as the result of a catastrophic brain injury. Her partner told police Kira had fought with a female guest in their home 2 days earlier, and during that altercation, Kira had hit her head on a cupboard. The autopsy report noted 105 signs of recent injury to Kira's body, as well as the blunt force trauma to Kira's head, including significant bruising to her eyes, lips, chin, right cheek and central forehead. The report detailed extensive bruising to Kira's back, neck, shoulders, abdomen, arms and legs. In October the following year, so just over a year after her death, Kira's family asked the police for an update on the investigation. They were told it had been concluded and no charges would be laid. The fight for a coronial inquest into Kira's death is the subject of the podcast series Beenham Valley Road. Jamie Pultz is a former member of the Queensland Police Service himself, and he has a lot of interesting things to say about a lot of things. But we started by talking about Kira's case and why he wanted to go back and investigate it in a podcast. You're one of those podcasts that's actually brought about an advance in the case that you've been talking about.
Yeah, well, I hope so. Like, they've announced they're going to do a coronial into Kira McLaughlin's death. So, I mean, that's
wow.
More than I could hope for, really. It's undetermined when that's going to be. We can hope, you know, in the next few months, but I would have liked it to have been last year, but, you know, you can't rush these things. It is the government we're dealing with, so. But, you know, if we can get a coronial happening, then surely we can shake the trees and something will fall.
What got you involved in this case in particular? Because I know, obviously, you come from a policing background and then you've left the service.
Yep.
So what got you into this case?
Well, basically, to put a long story short, what happened was I was in my first year in 2013 at Gympie Police Station, which is about an hour and a half north of Brisbane, and it's sort of like it's rural. You know, it's like country. And basically I was working there and I was exposed to a few incidents, domestic violence related, and the person that I was dealing with that was calling for service was Kira McLaughlin. At the time she was 27. She was a mother of four And I could relate to her because I was 27 and I had one son at the time. And so when I was dealing with her, I wasn't dealing with the normal, you know, clients that we would deal with as police officers. You know, I'm sure she had her faults and stuff like that, but for me, she was just like me, you know, 27 and a mother, and I was a father, and I could relate to her. And anyway, I dealt with the incidents that were in front of me, and then probably 6 months later, I heard, when I was sitting in Gympie, I can remember it exactly, I was sitting in the Gympie police station, and oh, I heard someone say, "Kira's died." And it just floored me, because I thought, shit, this is serious, you know, like this is, being a police officer is pretty serious. You deal with these things, and if you don't get it right, the consequences can be this bad. And that just stuck with me ever since, and I've thought about it ever since. Yeah. And then a few months later, I got sent to a different station, and so I sort of fell out of touch with that. And then when I left the police, I thought, you know what, I'm gonna have a look at this. And I contacted Tom, my other police mate who left, and he remembered it. And from there, we just started reaching out to people from Facebook and where we went.
It's a good story in that it also reminds people who aren't in the police about how intense the job is, because that's what it's like, I guess, the days that you rock up to work and find out that someone's died, someone that you remember really clearly for these reasons, various reasons. You can picture her, you picture her house, her home, her children, her family.
Exactly.
And the worst has happened.
Exactly. And it stays with you, you know, and it was nothing that, like, it wasn't my fault or anything. I don't, no. You know, but you do, you know, you do think, could I have done something different? You know, and Tom was the same, you know, could we have intervened in another way? And I know that the police have different programs in place now where they're trying to intervene with respondents, you know, earlier to see if they can put some measures in place to stop this sort of thing from happening. But at the end of the day, we will never stop domestic violence because there's so many variables, but we do need to educate, you know, both parties involved and try and find ways that, you know, the aggrieved, which is usually, not always, but usually the female, ways that they can reach out and find help, because there is help there. But from my experience in, you know, doing this podcast, the hardest thing for the aggrieved, or, you know, the person being subjected to domestic violence, is they have the hardest time actually saying they need help. It's like pride gets in the way. That's my experience anyway.
Yeah, no, I've heard a lot of people say the same thing, particularly when your family and friends are telling you over the course of sometimes years that they don't like him, or I wish you'd stop going out with him, I wish you'd leave him, and you don't, yeah, it can be hard to then go to them when you're in trouble. And in your podcast, you talk to Kira's mum, Alison, a lot.
Yeah.
A week later, we are pulling into the driveway of Alison's house. It's a large Queenslander on a nice bit of land. It has a block base with an open carport, and the house itself sits on top. There are fruit trees all around it, and behind the carport is a garden Alison has created to honour Kira's memory.
Alison looks like she sounds. She has kind, dark eyes, dark hair, and a warm smile. She looks like Kira's mum. Tom and I are aware that by talking to her, we are asking her to relive part of her life that still hurts like hell. But despite all that, she welcomes us back to her house, like her own grandkids.
I can't even think of words to describe her. She was out there. She was afraid of nothing. Fearless fly. You couldn't not notice her. You know, she was loud and she was opinionated and she was unique. Definitely would cover it, yes. We got a phone call from the next door neighbour, and she said, "Kira's just been taken away in an ambulance. They don't think she'll be coming back." So that was all I knew. Then I had to wait for her to get to Gympie Hospital. I rang Gympie Hospital and they really couldn't tell me too much. And then next thing I find out, she's going to be flown to Gold Coast Hospital because they couldn't get her into other hospitals who had CAT scanners. They needed to do a CAT scan on her brain and they didn't have one at Gympie. Yeah, so she got to the Gold Coast Hospital at 2 o'clock in the morning. That's when I spoke to the doctor and he was very apologetic and said basically that's it. The next door neighbour who'd rung us, I was in no fit state to drive, so I couldn't get to the hospital. So she was going to give me a lift down there. So I got down there. Kira had actually already been declared legally dead, and they were only keeping her alive for her organs at that stage.
How is she travelling now?
Yeah, I don't think she's terrific, to be honest. I speak to her quite, you know, quite often on the phone or, you know, through text messaging, but it's definitely done a lot of good for her to have the podcast. She's told me that she does feel a lot of relief in expressing what's happened and having the support and having the coronial about to happen, and you never know what will happen after that. So she does feel good about that. But I think at the same time, now that it's stopped and I've finished the podcast for the moment until there's something else to report on, I think that's kind of made her feel, I don't know, like deflated maybe.
Yeah.
It's all stopped and she doesn't want anyone to forget about Kira, which is, you know, rightfully so. And she doesn't want everyone just to move on, you know, just to go, okay, that was one podcast, let's go to the next one. She wants people to remember Kira, and she doesn't want to be – Alison doesn't want pity. She just wants people to remember Kira and to hopefully avoid situations like this in the future.
Did you launch a campaign just before Christmas? I think I read on your social media for Alison and the kids. So, Alison, does she have Kira's four kids now?
No, Kira's ex-husband before all this happened – has the four kids.
Right.
But Alison is involved with the grandkids. And actually Katie, who is one of the guests on my podcast, in episode 9, Watch the World Burn, she was Jason's ex of like 13 years. Anyway, she's the one who started the fundraiser for Alison and the grandkids.
For those of our listeners who haven't heard you yet, and I know they will rush to listen to your podcast, so Jason's the name you've given to the alleged perpetrator.
Yep.
So his ex-partner is actually now involved in supporting Kira's children.
Yeah, because it's quite a tangled rope, this one. Katie was Jason's partner at the time, and Katie and Kira became friends. And then Katie noticed that Kira and Jason started flirting or showing signs of a relationship. So that happened under her nose, and it was a classic example of, you know, domestic violence, because he just does what he wants anyway. So it's quite a weird dynamic, but yeah, Katie's got involved and she's raised money for Alison to buy Christmas presents for her kids, grandkids, and yeah, which is just, it's really good to see.
At the beginning of your podcast, we met Alison, mm-hmm. Kira's mum, and she couldn't even say this man's name. She couldn't even use the fake name that you'd given him. She was calling him It. And she didn't know anything about where he was at that time. She seemed so lost and so hopeless. And then you popped up and you were sort of a ray of hope in that it felt like somebody cared and somebody was offering to try and do something. And then you were able to give her some news that was shocking, but it was sort of positive, wasn't it, the news that you gave her about Jason's location?
Yeah, because she had been, you know, unaware of that. And when I called her to say, do you know where Jason is at the moment, she didn't know. And I'd found out through a different source, and I confirmed that by calling prisoner locations, that he was incarcerated. And I didn't know what for, and I don't know how much longer for, but anyway, he was in jail, and that was a great sign of relief. It was that little bit step closer, I guess, for Alison, to put in, you know, into perspective for your listeners. For lack of a better word, this guy's been walking around in the public without this incident catching up with him, and to find out that he was in jail was just like a breath of fresh air for her, to think that, okay, it might not be for my daughter's death, but it's for something. So I'll take some relief in that. And that's how she felt.
And that for that period of time, he wasn't bashing anyone else.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And, you know, just for your listeners who haven't heard the podcast, it's kind of unlike Been on Valley Road's unlike anyone else's, in the way that it's organic and raw. You know, it's unpolished, I suppose. Like, I've done this with Tom myself. We haven't had, you know, Channel 7 or anything behind us. It's just been us, and we've done literally everything from recording to interviewing to producing. And, you know, there's pros and cons to that. And so, you know, you got to bear with the bit of a amateurishness, I guess, but you know, we told the story, and that's the other thing. We didn't actually have much of a narrative. Just if anyone's going to go back and start this podcast series, we didn't have any narrative to start with. We, you know, I wasn't a cop anymore, so I couldn't go on the systems and just look it up. I had to just find it out through, you know, legal ways, which is from Facebook and meeting people, and they're telling me their little story. And so really we had no idea, and we've pieced this together just from a very organic way. So if any of your listeners are going to jump in there, just bear that in mind.
Yeah, well, that's what I like about it, because we're the same. We're not supported by any like television network or newspaper or anything like that. We just do it completely ourselves as well. And you call your media company 610 Media. Why is that?
610 is the job code in the Queensland Police Service for community assistance. We just thought, when we're thinking of names, it sort of stuck out to me. So when you go to a job, the police radio operator would say to you over the radio, okay, we got a 610 over in Melbourne, and that's what you know it's a community assistance job. So I thought, well, that's a good idea. Let's just do. But you know.
But so why did you leave the police service?
Well, I guess at the time, I didn't want to admit it, but at the time I was burnt out, and I was only in there for, you know, just under 4 years, but that's pretty common in that job, that you do burn out. It's like any job. You have your little periods where you burn out, and it's the same with, you know, apprentices in every industry. There's like a time where people, you know, commonly burn out, and where I was at in the police was that time. And, you know, I had a pretty rough first year, but I've got through that, started enjoying it, and then I just started burning out. And I could have just taken, you know, annual leave or sick leave or whatever and, you know, pushed through. But I had a family business offer, and, you know, I just thought, why not? I'm just going to go for it. And, you know, I wouldn't be doing this podcast, that's for sure, if I was still in the police. So it's opened up a whole other avenue of podcasts for me. So I'm kind of happy about it now.
Yeah, so you've still got the interest in that community service that took you into policing, but you found another outlet for it.
Exactly. Like, I enjoyed the job, but there's just so much red tape that goes along with it and, you know, bullshit, for lack of a better word. it's just, yeah, it's not just you rock up and help someone. There's so many other things to it. There's so much paperwork and stress, I guess, and you have to have the right type of personality that can just leave it all at the door and come home and forget about it. But I would just, you know, tweak on the fact that I've got so much work to do and court documents to prepare, and, you know, it just stress me out. So,
yeah, no, I get it. I'm really bad at admin, so I totally get that. And you're not the first person to say that either, that the paperwork is what is such a drag.
Oh, I can't even put it into words. There is so much paperwork, like every single interaction with the person. And not only just one place, you've actually got to write it in your notebook, and then you go back and write it on a computer, and then you got to do a different system. And it's just, yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I can see why they have to have it. It's for, you know, covering, it's a bit of CYA Act, which is cover your ass, and it's also for future jobs, they know what's going on, which is definitely important. You know, it's how domestic violence works, really. So they'll calculate how many jobs of service are going to that address. They'll work out what's happening there. Are there the key things like property damage and injury to people? Is there threatening behaviour? What kind of abuse is happening here? And they can give it a priority based on the previous jobs. So I can understand why you have to do all that paperwork so the next officer knows what they're coming into, but it does take a lot of time. So, and you don't really know that until you go.
And so also then when somebody goes to court, they have all of this material to back them up, right? Because people always tell us, you know, you should call the police every time. You should get that stuff on record so that when you want to go and get an AVO or whatever it is, go to family court, you've got all of this stuff on record.
Oh, 100%. And also, if anyone's in the situation, which I know there are plenty of people who are, if you are in a situation where you think you're the subject of domestic violence, start taking your own evidence. Write down times, get a notepad, you know, that you're not going to get caught with. Write a notepad with, you know, dates, times and entries of what's happening. Even if you can use your voice recorder on your phone, anything. And that's not just domestic violence, that's any crime. If you can document, you're going to help, you know, the court, you're going to help the police officers who come. It makes a whole world of difference. So that's a bit of advice I have for people.
It's good advice, because I think, yeah, we underestimate how seriously that is taken. We think, really, if I just write that down, keep my own diary, but that is actual evidence, isn't it?
Oh, of course it is, because, you know, the judge is presiding over these cases, and they've only got what we've given them, or what the, you know, the applicant has given them. They're not there for the 24 hours a day that you're in that relationship. So they really need to see it in its entirety. And that's the way to do it, is by writing. Like, we used to go to jobs and there'd be people who have, like Katie, for example, in my podcast, one of the exes of this Jason fella. She's got a 13-page summary, very brief summary of everything she went through. And it's incredible. She's kept everything. You know, she's written down times and phone calls and what they were and what happened. And I mean, that's just, it makes everybody's job so much easier in so many ways. So, and it's something to look back on too for her.
And while you're giving advice, we recently had a lady on our show who is trying to get an inquest going. And we've had a few people on the show before who have managed to do that, but I never thought to ask them, how do you do that? And this lady, her second cousin was murdered in 1991, and it's unsolved. And so still they are trying to get something done about
it. Get an inquest. Yep.
Yeah. And so she started a campaign, letter writing. She started her own podcast, all of these things. What's your advice? How do you go about it?
That's a great question. And I think what we did, so Peter Boyce is a pretty well-known lawyer up here, and he's had a lot to do with the Daniel Morcombe case, and he's been working pro bono on Kira McLaughlin's case. And basically he's been putting pressure on the coroner's office, so he's been writing to the coroner. And also what we found that I think really pushed this one over the line was we went on ABC radio and we spoke to Annie Gaffney, and she then reached out to the coroner's office and asked for a reply. And all of a sudden they turn around and say, yeah, we're going to do an inquest. Like, it's, so I think it was the media, to be honest with you. I think the media pushed that over the line, and then away we go. It hasn't happened yet, but that's how we did it. We just went on ABC and said we wanted a coronial inquest, and then they went and asked the coroner, why haven't there been an inquest yet? And all of a sudden they're doing an inquest.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Because in Victoria, we've got the most recent example of the Trace podcast that brought about a second inquest in the Maria James case. So, yeah, you're probably right, you know.
Well, it's media. It's it's public interest. I mean, so she started like the campaign to get signatures and all that. So it is definitely public interest. So that's something you need to address. But, yeah, the media can approach the direct family members to write to the coroner's office. If you can get the police to start pursuing that line of inquiries as well, it's not always easy. But, yeah, I don't know if there's any right or wrong way to get a coronial. I think you just got to yell it from the rooftops until someone listens.
Now, what's going on with your mate Tom Daunt? Now, is he's not involved in the podcast anymore? Is that right?
No, that's right. So about episode 5, Missing Pieces, and Tom and I both discuss mental health pretty openly on the podcast, but at this one point I noticed Tom was, you know, withdrawing a little bit, and I know that he's had, you know, anxiety and a bit of OCD and PTSD, what he says himself anyway on one of our blog episodes, Tear It Down. He explains all of that, but I just noticed he was withdrawing a bit. And at one point I said, mate, you know, do you want to pull out? And he said, yeah, I do. And it was just too much at the time. It wasn't just the content we were doing. It was just the workload. As you know, it's like, it's very time consuming. Like, I'm spending 20 hours a week at least. And he was, you know, feeling that as well. So he stepped out, and we've just recently, I spoke to Tom, and he's going to step out of the business entirely. He's not going to be writing or doing podcasts anytime soon, just to focus on his health and, you know, his family. And so unfortunately mental health can sort of rear its ugly head, you know, anytime it wants. And he had to take a step back, and it's pretty brave of him to actually say that, and, you know, for thousands of people to hear. So I take my hat off to him for that.
Yeah, it is, and it's also great that you guys have got that relationship and that you have that understanding that you're able to see the signs and start that conversation and, you know.
Yeah, and look, it was a bit difficult to start with. It was always that little bit awkward, you know. You could have kind of got to say, mate, is everything okay? And they say, yeah. And then you're like, no, something is up. And then it just flowed from there. But, you know, he's definitely not weak. It's just that's a stereotype that we really want to get, you know, we want to get rid of that, that, you know, mental health is like breaking your arm. If you've got a broken arm, you go and get it treated. And he needs to, his own words were, I need to step back and just make sure I'm being a responsible parent, you know, being present for work and, you know, being just there for your family. Because, you know, if you know anything about mental health, you just go inside yourself and you just, yeah, it can just be, it can be messy. So he's done the right thing, you know, for himself and for his family. So I hope that he gets better as soon as possible and he can start writing again, because he's actually a journalist by trade and he's a good writer. So it's a good gift he's got.
Yeah, he's definitely done the right thing, which will more likely enable him to be able to come back into writing than try to push through.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, got it.
Exactly.
Good idea. Now, you are moving on to another case which is close to our hearts on this show, and I'm looking really forward to hearing it, very forward to hearing it, because I was going to do a follow-up to an episode we did and then I decided not to because I thought, no, you guys are going to cover it so much better than I could ever. It is the Graham Stafford / Leanne Holland case.
Yeah, exactly.
When can we look forward to the launch of your podcast into Who Killed Leanne Holland?
April 1st is the date we're looking at this year, 2020. Could give or take a few weeks. But, yeah, basically, if you want to know how that all came about, it was through Beenham Valley Road. We started, you know, recording Beenham Valley Road, and then Graham Crowley, who authored the book Who Killed Leanne Holland, and is also an ex-Queensland police detective and also an ex-private investigator. He was hired by the Stafford family in 92 to investigate this case. And anyway, after, I don't know how long he was working for them, but after that he kept going and he's been looking at it ever since. And he felt like an injustice had been done involving Graham Stafford. So basically he wrote the book and he's done a lot of research. He's put a lot of work into it. And he reached out to me, and through the podcast, he started offering me some advice and some mentorship about my podcast, about investigating, about, you know, all sorts of things. And we've become friends, even though we've never met in person. We've become, you know, friends. And then we started talking about, you know, doing a podcast together. And so, you know, there we are. He's currently nomading around Australia with his wife. When he comes back, it's going to be, he's writing at the moment, and when he comes back, we're going to be hitting the studio and getting that podcast out. So April 1st is what we're looking at, and it's going to have unprecedented access. We got Graham Stafford and Joe Crowley, the defence barrister, Graham Crowley, Greg Carey from the 4BC, who was quite involved in it.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And Graham Crowley has been so great with us as well.
While he thinks that an injustice was done, he's going to be very open to the fact that if he finds any evidence that supports Graham Stafford being the killer, then he will present that and he will stand by it. But just on the flip side, if he finds evidence that's going to prove otherwise, he'll present that too. And he's going to make that promise for everybody to hear that.
And it sounds like you live somewhere beautiful. I can hear all the beautiful birds in the background and...
I live in a place called the Sunshine Coast, which is in Queensland, and I think it's about 29 degrees at the moment. It's muggy though, it's really hot. I'm about to go to the beach. So yeah, it can't complain.
Sounds like life is good. All right, well, I'm going to hold you up one more minute. I'm sure the kids are standing by to go out and about. Thank you so much for your time, Jamie.
No worries, Michelle. Thanks for having me on, guys. I really appreciate it. And, yeah, go ahead and listen to Beenham Valley Road once you're done listening to all of Australian true crime.
After the break, an update from one of Beenham Valley Road's most memorable guests. But first, thank you to the following patrons: Cherie, Brian E. Haig, Laura Riley, Danielle Hand, Emma Hoffman, and Olivia G.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Thank you to these patrons, V.D. Brown, Courtney Toomer, Catherine Vasili and Tariq Edwards. As Jamie mentioned before the break, in episode 9 of Beenham Valley Road, he spoke to Katie, who'd been in a relationship with the man who was with Kira McLaughlin on the night she died. Katie's description of their relationship was harrowing to listen to, and I've always wondered how she's going now and how she felt about telling her story publicly.
I've thrown myself in the deep end by going back to TAFE to get my grade 12 equivalent, and it's all on computers. The Wednesday to Friday was very overwhelming because I don't understand computers at all. When I finished grade 12, computers were actually only just being introduced.
Yeah, same.
So...
Yeah, we had a computer room that you would go in like 1 hour a week every class, you know?
Yeah, that's what we had.
And now my kids do everything on iPads at school.
Don't remind me. I'm going to get my two middle children, they've got, through the school luckily, I can pay it. I've got a payment plan and stuff like that. They've got to get iPads now too. So.
Oh no, it's full on, isn't it?
It's insane, it really is.
But you'll pick it up.
It's getting there. It's getting there. I just need to remember to take a step back and don't overwhelm myself so much with it and take a breather and then go back to it. And I'm getting the hang of it.
Do you want to do anything specifically after that?
Hopefully the grades I get, passing grades that I get, will help me be able to get into the Bachelor of Education.
Oh, great.
Well, it was always before shit hit the fan and all the rest of it. What I was planning on doing when I finished grade 12 was the Bachelor of Education. My goal was to be a secondary English teacher.
Yeah, wonderful.
But as life changes and stuff like that, and you grow a dislike towards people and stuff like that, you turn more towards animals. So back in 2014, I started studying online for a certificate for in veterinary nursing. But then again, life happened and I had to put that on the back burner.
How are you feeling about the podcast? I mean, I know it's probably a long time ago now that you recorded your interview with Jamie and that it came out and all that.
I feel terrible. Like, I'm glad that I was able to help or shed some light on some things for him or whatnot. But I feel terrible that I swore so much. It's a problem I have. I don't even know I'm doing it. My husband, my kids call me up on it all the time. When I'm extremely nervous, I swear a lot. And it's And I think it takes away a lot of credibility for that part of the podcast for him. And I feel terrible because, you know, that's a side to that story that needs to really be understood, to understand what happened to Kira and all the rest of it. So
I think it was a pretty intense conversation you were having. I didn't think it took away anything. And also my kids are always saying to me, you couldn't go one day without swearing, could you, Mum? So I think it's pretty normal, and that's not what I thought when I finished that episode. I didn't think, wow, she swore a lot. That was not what I was thinking about.
No, a lot of people that obviously don't understand or haven't, how would you put it, I'd say investigated those sorts of situations and things like that, a lot of people live life with rose-coloured glasses on, so they don't understand or comprehend the amount of emotion, the amount of trauma, the amount of abuse and things like that that someone in that sort of situation has been through.
Yeah. Had you spoken much about all of that trauma in a while?
Not really, no. I speak with my husband a lot about it. I have a handful of close-knit friends, my family even. Back in 2013 when I escaped, my mum was over the moon, just very, very scared and worried that I'd go back again, considering the amount of times I did leave and unfortunately got roped back in by the lies and the crap from not just himself but his family as well, especially his mother and older sister, always, always putting it down as, you know, it takes two to tango and things like that, and the children deserve their to have their dad in their life and things like that. Like, yeah, I do understand that. They do, but he does not consider himself, or he doesn't. He constantly accused me of cheating and things like that, and never, and every time he was abusing me and things like that, he would say that the children aren't his. So quite frankly, I believe he has no rights whatsoever. It's not a right to have a child. It's a privilege and a responsibility.
I remember you saying that he would wake up in the morning and accuse you of cheating the night before when you were in bed with him the whole night.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, that happened pretty much on a daily basis for about, that went on for about 11, 12 years.
God, that's a,
yeah.
That's a huge part of your life, isn't it?
It is. A huge part of my life, a huge regret, but also in turn it's a massive life lesson learned to teach my children, especially my boys, not to be anything like that, my girl, to stand up for herself and speak up.
How do you recover from that, from 12 years of that level of anxiety and abuse? Like, where do you start?
I'm still on the recovery path, actually. My husband is a great help to that. I honestly can't answer that question for everyone, but for me, I've learned to detach emotionally from when I have to speak about it.
Yeah.
I suffer extreme depression and extreme social anxiety. I have PTSD and agoraphobia, so I have to force myself to actually leave the house. It makes me sick to even think of leaving the house. My anxiety goes through the roof. I've had multiple panic attacks over it and all the rest of it, but I've found I was slowly working on it. I guess one of the biggest ways to just keep pushing yourself and look forward.
Yeah.
I found for myself meditation and getting back into my martial arts is what has helped me.
Yeah, I can see that. I've never been into martial arts, but I can see how I can. I can understand from what I've read and heard that. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I found meditation helped me with my mind because of the depression. I suffer extreme suicidal thoughts and tendencies as well. So I was in a very dark place in about 2014, and my husband got in contact with his old meditation instructor, and so we started going to meditation once a week. And that taught me to control my thoughts. So when I was having negative thoughts or anything like that, insane, you pretty much grab them and throw them away. And so you tell yourself that's not what you need to be listening to right now, and now you start thinking more positive thoughts. So, yeah, that I found that's what helped me.
How did you go trusting another man again and trusting a relationship again?
Well, with my husband, it was easy because we've always been lifelong friends, but we lost contact when he left high school. But we actually dated back in high school, so high school sweethearts. Back in 2011 when I escaped him once before, yeah, I got in contact with some old friends and stuff, and I found my husband on Facebook and messaged him and asked him how he was going and things like that. Mm. And then Jason got his calls back in and I went back. And then in 2013 when all hell broke loose and him and Kira and all the rest of it, and I was awake for 5 weeks straight, couldn't sleep, I was afraid of being killed in my sleep. So, you know, to help keep me awake so I could just watch the kids sleep and things like that, I got back on Facebook and I contacted some. I bit my tongue and I bit my pride a lot because I hate asking for help. And so I asked for help. I asked my childhood friend first, but unfortunately she was over in England at the time. And then suggested people, you know, popped up, and my husband popped up, and I was like, okay, this is going to sound really weird, but I need help. I'm so sorry to be blunt, but I'm trying to escape and all that bit. And he, yeah, that was it. We were talking for 5 weeks straight. And then he helped me and my children escape and be safe. It did not start off as a relationship at all. It was just friends and a place to stay for 2 weeks while I was searching for a house myself and my children. But as the weeks went on, it just progressed back to where we left, I guess.
Yeah. And I'm sure at the time people were saying to you, don't get into another relationship. You've just gotten out of this terrible, abusive relationship. You're not ready. This is a bad idea. And yet here we are 6-7 years later, and it's still great.
Actually, I had nobody around then. I was unfortunately still had Jason's mum and sisters trying to manipulate me in any way that they could. But I just turned around and said, no, enough's enough. And I was doing what was best for my children. I got them in school. We were in a stable place. That's what mattered to me, was getting my children back into their routine, making sure they're stable and have somewhere and have food in all the time. That was one of the biggest things that just blew my mind, was the kids were able to eat every day. I was never worrying about whether or not they're going to eat or what they're going to eat or if they're going to get in trouble for eating.
He used food as a tool of abuse with the kids?
No. Money was the biggest problem, or one of the biggest problems. We never had enough money because he was a drug addict and an alcoholic.
God, I can't imagine that. I mean, you know, we all have problems, but I can't imagine not being able to feed our kids in Australia because their dad's so selfish.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the biggest things. We always had to make sure he was always happy.
Yeah.
Otherwise, but even then, even when he had what he wanted, we still copped it. So,
how did they recover? How have they recovered? Have you seen behavioural issues with them or emotional issues?
No. No, they're doing good. When we escaped in 2013, my main priority was stability and all that. And then after that, the priority was seeking counselling and stuff like that, and trying to do things by the book, because I gave him strict conditions that he could call between certain times, the kids every night and things like that. he'd call the kids, but then he'd ask, you know, as the elders to call me names and things like that. And then it got to the point where it's like, nah, you know what, enough is enough. I'm going to do this the proper way. So I contacted mediation and he would not comply. So because I know how terrible the family court system is and things like that, I was not dragging my children through that and I was not forcing them to do anything they did not want to do. So they saw a counsellor for a year. Yes, unfortunately, it took them away from school a couple of times, but they're quick learners. They're resilient.
Yeah.
And, no, I don't know how to explain that their recovery is pretty much not turning out like that, seeing the negatives and turning them into positives, helping their friends, helping their family members.
Well, it sounds like you've worked really hard on it. I mean, I don't know.
Doing good at school.
What else you could have done? It sounds like you've...
Yeah, well, the main thing was making sure that they were always safe. I don't hide anything from my children.
What was happening in 2013, by the way, when you say that everything just got really bad?
2013 was when he was with Kira. I think July was when Jason moved over there, and August was my birthday. He demands I give him what I had left of my money so that he could buy me a birthday present and things like that. And I'm like, I'm not even good. I don't want anything for my birthday.
See, I would have imagined, I imagined that once he started seeing Kira and moved over there that he would leave you alone, that he left.
Oh, hell no. Oh. Hell no. I still copped all the abuse. I still copped the whinging, the bitching. And as soon as the kids would get on the school bus at 8 o'clock in the morning, he'd be right over, still abusing me, still accusing me, treating me like an absolute piece of shit and all the rest of it. Yeah. No, I still copped it all and still got sexually assaulted as well because, you know, if Kira had her kids home and stuff like that and he wasn't getting what he wanted, well, he'd come over and, yeah, use me instead. Jason's dad called me Saturday. I think it was the 19th of July of 2014. It would have been about lunchtime, around 11:30, 12 o'clock, because I was outside hanging up my children's washing. Jason's dad called me and told me Kira was dead. At first I did not believe him. And then he told me everything Jason had told him leading up to Kira's death. I was a mess for 4 days. My children thought they were misbehaving or had done something wrong. My husband and I explained to the children that, no, you haven't done anything wrong. I've just heard some really devastating news. I'm trying to cope with it at the moment. And we were figuring out how we were going to let them know. So I called my mum and my stepdad, who were living up that way at the time. I messaged her first, and I said, "Is what I'm hearing fucking true?" She called me instantly and goes, "How the fuck do you know?" And I told her and all the rest of it, and she turned around to me in tears and she goes, "This is what your dad and I have always been scared to hear. This is every time we're watching the news, this is our biggest fear. This is what we have been afraid of, afraid that would happen to you." And I asked my mum, I said, "What the fuck do I do with this information, with everything I've just been told? What the fuck do I do?" She said, "Call the police station, ask for the investigating officer and tell them everything." And then I said, what do I do about telling the kids, because I am an absolute mess mum and they don't, they're getting scared and they're getting stressed because they think they've done something wrong, but they haven't, and I don't know how to say it to them. She just turned around to me and said, well, you've never told, never kept anything from them before. Never kept anything from them before. Don't keep this from them either, because as that, when they get older and you turn around and tell them all about it and the timeline and all that, they're going to turn around and go, why didn't you tell us? I don't believe in lying to my children. I don't make them promises because I know there is going to be the potential that I cannot keep them. So I sat them down and I told them, and yes, it upset them. They were quite distraught, and they, the eldest actually straight away said he did it. When I called the investigating officer, he asked if I would be willing to do a statement. I said yes. For about a month to 2 months, I was being picked up on a daily basis by a detective from the local police station close to me. And I was going through the 13 years of diaries and calendars and crap that I have, compressed it down to a 12 to 13 page dot point file for them, and gave them all the information in regards to what I was told. And after that, I've heard nothing more.
Really?
Yep.
So that would have been 2014, I guess.
Yes, that was, yeah, that was in 2014.
God.
Right after.
Yeah. And when was the last time you saw Jason? Did you see him again after Kira died?
Hell no. Hell no. No way. I've heard things along the grapevine here and there, but obviously he's never gone to jail for what he deserves to be going to jail for.
But when Jamie talked about it in the podcast, that was the first you'd heard about it as well?
Yeah. Mm. I hear things along the grapevine.
I bet. Because you would still have mutual friends or something.
No
mutual friends.
No, I've cut all contacts, all ties.
Right.
Because I don't, that's my past, that I do not want that affecting my children anymore.
Yeah.
You know, they've got their own lives. They deserve to live their own lives. They deserve to build themselves a better future than what they would have had we have kept any of them in our life.
Mm. Gosh. Amazing story. And, you know, amazing life that you've built now.
Yeah, I like to think so. I like to hope so.
Yeah. After having someone actively try and destroy you like that.
Mentally, physically, emotionally.
Yeah.
In every way, shape, possible form.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a long recovery process. Mm. It is a very, very long road. Constantly being told that you're this, you're that, you're a slut, you're a whore, you know, you're a cheater, you sneak out and all the rest of it. When all I did was try and help him, try and build him up and make him a better person and all the rest of it, and then process destroying myself.
How about the drive that you had before Christmas to raise money for Alison and the kids? How did that go?
Yes, I was trying to stay anonymous as possible. But no, that blew my mind. That was just amazing. That puts that little bit of faith back in humanity.
Well, finding out you were behind it was amazing to me. I thought, God, as if she doesn't have enough to do in her life. That's so... That's so thoughtful.
Yeah. Well, you know, I know what it's like. I've been there. I've been in that boat where how the heck am I going to even give the kids a Christmas this year and things like that. And I just thought, well, you know, I do know those children. those children were friends with my children. I do miss them. And I thought, well, my nan, grandma, whatever she likes to be called, deserves to give them a Christmas that Kira would be happy to see.
From one mum to another.
Yeah.
How much did you raise? How'd it go?
Oh, goodness, I can't remember, but I know it hit well over the mark. I think it was near over $1,000.
So you wanted 200. That's what you were aiming for?
Yeah, that's all I was aiming for, just to help her out a little bit. And then it snowballed with Mum just like, oh, wow, okay.
Good people, so many good people in this story. That's the thing about it. So many really, really deeply good people in this story.
Yeah.
And all of you have this one person in common, unfortunately.
Unfortunately.
Thank you so much for your time today. I can't thank you enough for going through this story again, but I know that I'm not the only listener to Beenham Valley Road thinking about you and thinking, how's Katie going? I hope she's going well. And I hope that you didn't regret talking on the podcast. And I didn't mean about the swearing at all. All I meant was like putting your story out there, putting yourself out there, you know, for a lot of people is like a bit of a shock to the system to tell your story to some one guy and then suddenly have people saying, hey, I heard you on that podcast.
It throws a lot of people off, especially when I've got to meet new people and all the rest of it. It actually threw a lot of the class that I'm in at TAFE, it threw a lot of them off.
Yeah, right.
Because I don't look like someone that's got four kids now and been through hell and back.
Yeah.
I don't come off as someone like that. I'm loud and infectious and boisterous and that's all a part of my anxiety. Putting on a smile, but deep down inside I'm screaming, oh, my God.
A lot of us are.
Yeah, that's true. And when you turn around and, you know, step outside of your shell a little bit and you speak to some others and stuff like that, you realise, you're not the only one sitting there going, tell us, how come we're going to get through this?
Yeah. Oh, you're going to be such a great teacher. You're going to be such a good high school teacher. If this podcast has raised issues for you and you'd like to speak to somebody about it, you can call 1-800-RESPECT on 1-800-737-732. Don't forget to download Beenham Valley Road wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your dollar a month trial today at shopify.com/records.
Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.